We have been studying Abhidharma for the last several weeks, and we're coming to we've been studying what's called the five skandhas, which are basically what we would call the general constituencies of our ego, our ego structure, or our ego habit, our notion of constantly having a reference point we call me and believing it's real. And we started with what seemed to be fairly abstract and very profound, at least. Other people might have another word saying, what the hell are they talking about? You know, I mean, basically, it's been more difficult to understand what we were doing, because this is not something we have generally in our what we call psychological vocabulary, and it's certainly not something in Western theory of what people are or what reality is. And we started with form, then we went to feeling, then we went to perception, then we went to formation, and now we are at the fifth and final of these five skandhas, which are basically heaps of energy which assemble and sort of pile together and cohere into some kind of what we would call groping animal, often putting very fancy terms on it. But the interesting thing is, and this is the most interesting thing about consciousness, is that actually, from where we are with consciousness, once we understand what consciousness is, it sort of puts the whole thing together. It makes it possible to go back and actually get a better understanding of those previous skandhas. And the reason why is because this is the one we encounter when we practice meditation. I mean, we're not going to really encounter the flickering of this primordial ground, you know, with these kind of emanations that flashes out and flash out and then and disappear on and on and on, endlessly and in some sense timelessly. And it's hard for us to understand that second skandha of the feeling, which is just basically a sort of an initial coating of this kind of disturbance and sense of anxiety that things are never permanent, everything is constantly in a state of flux, and then we have the way we perceive things and organize our and decide what we like and don't like, and then we have the whole organizational process of what we call concept. That's the fourth skandha, which we went through. But the fifth one is what makes it all sort of seamlessly appear to be me, sort of like without. People don't walk around feeling like I'm contradicting myself every 50th of a second, when in fact we are. But we have this kind of experience of continuity. We call it continuity. So did everyone have a chance to read this chapter, assuming you've been coming to class? Anybody not?
I didn't.
You didn't, okay.
Well, buried in the bardo.
Okay, well, the bardos aren't going to really be able to be understood, actually, unless we get this skandha business down, because they appear in so many manifold different ways that the bardo thing is something else we can start to look at down the road, because we're all going to die. So it's perfectly reasonable to get ready at some point, and realize also the world we're in right now is also called a bardo, an intermediate state. And we're experiencing all the elements we will encounter in the other bardos, but we just don't recognize them any more than we recognize how every 300th of a second everything is appearing and disappearing. So that's why we're training in meditation.
Can I just ask generally, are the bardos the wheel? The realms of...
No, it's not part of this topic. We haven't mentioned it.
Okay.
No. The bardos, don't worry about the wheel now.
Okay.
You'll end up with a wheel later if you don't take care of it.
I have one now.
We're experiencing the wheel right now.
Chipmunks.
Yeah. No problem. So, I think that was a really important element. Emily called me today and started asking me, well, what do you think about how we're going to talk about helping people understand why, how they can relate to this stuff in meditation? I'm saying, this is it. This is the one where we can actually do this. We can actually work with the skandhas, and particularly the fifth skandha, because the fifth skandha is sort of the one that we actually would say, we have a so-called first one, two, three, four, five. It's this one where in our actual direct experience we encounter the whole ups and downs, the whole kind of big storyline we feed each other, and mainly ourselves. I mean, in terms of this, we'll just start with ourselves.
And the fifth skandha is called?
Consciousness. It's called consciousness. And we say we are conscious because we say I'm here and you are there, and because I can't know what hot is without knowing what cold is, and the entire system of dualistic kind of means of experience in which we begin to understand how we operate. We do. I mean, this is just phenomena and how our brains work. We have a bifurcated brain. You know, there's lots of things that would support that. But the fact is, consciousness really is something that is utterly taken for granted. And people assume when they're conscious that they are awake, which is actually far from the case. If we've read this chapter, we get a little bit of an understanding of that. So just to briefly explain how in meditation this works, we have shamatha. Shamatha is resting the mind. Shamatha is basically allowing the mind to open up to space. And we do this through the breathing, through at the end of the out-breath, letting a little gap occur. And as we go forward with relaxing and resting, and relaxing is absolutely key to this whole process, because if we're not relaxing, it's not going to happen. We're getting some kind of an open space. And in that open space, we're starting to pop this kind of flow of words, dialogue, storyline, narrative that's talking about yours truly, right? Continuously. Reference is whether I'm thinking about other people, it's still my view of what they are, my perceptions of what they are. It's all based on me. It's all based on my interpretations and my evaluations. So the hope and fear, the whole question of what was yesterday licking my wounds and trying to gain from that and anticipating tomorrow is all just a big part of the storyline. So in this little process of this little space, this little openness, something happens. We pop it. It just pops. It pops open. There's a little break between that chain link of one thought after the other, after the other, after the other. So that we can directly experience. That's the first aspect, just having a sense of gap and openness. We don't know what's in that openness. That's okay. All we do is we begin to see it. There's a momentary kind of cessation of this wrap, or end of just one particular wrap, and the next second we know we're on another. But we had a moment. There's a little break there. And we can try, of course, we can do this off the cushion in moments of just physically being on the squat. When we actually bring our meditation into action, we're engaging with that mindfulness of just being present. The vipassana side is actually seeing how this whole thing works. So we actually start to perceive how this consciousness business works, how our narrative works, how our storyline continues, and how it keeps on getting added to and modified, subtracted, reinterpreted, re-edited. And so we begin to see how we've talked a little bit about the six consciousnesses, right? Does anybody have any questions about that right now? Eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, or touch, and mind, which in this case is simply organizing. It's the way which our perceptions actually hold together in some kind of cogency, which is just completely neutral in itself, having no problem. There's nothing intrinsically wrong with the five or six senses at all. We have what's called the seventh consciousness, which is the big problem. And it's intimately tied with the fifth skanda. The seventh consciousness is called afflicted mind, generally speaking. And it's doing this dance of going back and forth between what is actually appearing in the sixth consciousness of, you know, the organizing and the just processing of experience, and going back and forth with interpretations and of holding or imposing something on that, or causing it to sort of throw a wrench in the work continuously. That's how we get uptight. Why would it be on a wonderful, beautiful day such as we've been experiencing the last few days, when there's absolutely nothing to complain about? You know, all we do is end up finding ourselves completely pushed out of shape and complaining when, you know, actually everything is fine. I mean, this is exaggerated, but fundamentally, and from the ultimate level, everything is fine. In our Buddhist teachings, we learn that basically, in reality, there is no problem at all. Everything is fundamentally fine. And we mess it up continuously. We're constantly discovering how to make a mess out of something in itself that's completely fine.
What do you mean fundamentally fine? Elaborate.
Well, you had an introduction, we've had an introduction to what we call emptiness, which is fundamentally completely open beyond any kind of concept or filter. Just we've had experiential, we've attempted to sort of open and work with that and continually try to employ this in our practice. And we begin when we actually can rest in this complete state of openness, there's a natural brightness that occurs in itself. When we're not trying to take care of everything and fix things and somehow address all of our issues, but just simply be, being, just being, and letting be, there's a natural simplicity and a natural openness, a natural brightness, and it's very uplifted, actually. So, you know, this is called, without getting too complicated right now, purity, completely pure. In Buddhist terms, it's completely pure. It's completely unsullied, no matter what form it takes. It doesn't matter whether it's pleasing or unpleasing, it feels good or it's painful. It's got nothing to do with that. In itself, it's completely pure. It's also completely impermanent, as is everything. There is nothing that is permanent. And so this purity is also, that's considered kind of like essence that we talked about. Did we talk about the Dharmakaya? I can't remember.
Long time ago.
Yeah.
Not the
Dharmakaya. Then we have, and it's luminous, it's basically rich, it's constantly emerging with form, with sensation, with experience, with appearance. So that, it's all completely open. And what the Buddha is saying, the Buddha mind is saying, it's completely fine. Everything is good. You know, it's wonderful, actually. So then, you know, this is kind of primordial state. So what we want to do in our practice, ultimately, is to recover what's here already. It never left. It's already here right now. It's the most intimate reality thing we have. It's just simply reality as it is. So that's the good news. The best of it is, you know, the difficulty, right? We call that, why are you Buddhists so pessimistic? What are you saying? Everything is terrible, painful, you know, life is suffering. Because we're not paying attention to what's really in front of us, really, what's really here, what we are. Okay. So, let's see. So, by the way, please feel free to interrupt me as I go through this little summary of what we've been.
You went to seventh consciousness.
Yeah.
You said there are eight.
Yeah, so the eighth one is the storehouse. It's basically. So we have this storehouse. We introduced it in terms of it's both has all the keys to what we would call resolving this fundamental conflict and problem, but it's also got all the issues that make the problems there. It's got all the karmic and habitual tendencies, the latent factors. I'm going to introduce something here when we get into
it. It's like the hard drive.
The hard drive, yeah, that's a good way of putting it. Yeah. So there's a big aliyah, and then there's a little smaller aliyah. And the big aliyah is ultimate, and this is what I talked about when I said everything's fine, perfectly pure, primordially wonderful, blah, blah, blah. The little aliyah has got the other baggage. That's what we're carrying around. And it's what we didn't really go yet into what we call the nidanas. We did touch on it briefly. That's what's in the circle. and the first nidana is ignorance. So that just fundamentally why we end up...
The little
alia
is simply
a latent... you could say it's a container of, as Emily was talking about, hard drive. It's basically the kind of like the unconscious...
But she simply asked if it was the eighth consciousness, and I think the answer to that would be yes.
Yes.
Okay, the little alia is the eighth consciousness.
Yes. Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. Exactly.
Okay.
Right.
Storehouse.
Yeah, and so that seventh consciousness is dancing back and forth between the eighth and the sixth and trying to mess around and pull things out of the eighth and throw it into the sixth and say, okay, this is actually what you're seeing. This is why you have to be worried. This is why you don't want to like that person.
The sixth is pure.
The sixth is pure.
Takes the eighth and throws it into the sixth and says, here's a mess.
Yeah, basically it's throwing a wrench in the works because it's confused. It's confused and it's trying to always make things work because it has this sort of thing, a case of mistaken identity.
The sixth is mind.
Yeah, mind.
Okay. Yeah, yeah. So just recapping very quickly, I did want to just mention, so there's something going to happen here. The eighth consciousness is the fulfillment of these previous, the fifth skana, which is consciousness, is the fulfillment or the completion of the fruition of the previous four skandhas we're talking about, because it makes it all seem like it's all working as one thing. And
that's a key point.
Yeah, because that's why we actually think, we tend to think we're solid.
Yeah.
Even though 5 minutes ago I was somebody else manifesting a completely different personality, I'm just me, you know. I mean, and I don't even know who that other person is because I'm not paying attention to how much I live this contradiction all the time in every way. And unassimilation. The disunity, the fundamental disunity that we call ourselves, you know, this thing. And we like to think of ourselves as constant, as real, and eternal, of course.
And the first four, as contrasted to the fifth. The fifth, I think of the first four as like the swamp. And the fifth is sort of emerging out of the swamp. So there's a sense of consciousness, of seeing. The first four, as we said, they happen so fast, you can't really distinguish them, even though we're parsing it and putting them in little pieces just to try to explain how we develop ego. Because ego seems so real and solid. Well, how did we get there? Mm-hmm. But we can try to take it apart, but in our daily life, we're not likely to see those first four steps. Consciousness, where we are now, the fifth skandha, is more... We see things more. Is that true? Or how do you use
I'd say it's more like the icing on the cake, to quote out of the book, it's fruition in the form as the potential to the eight consciousness. In other words, all of the eight consciousnesses then are operative. And so, as I say, the sixth consciousness is called mind. In Sanskrit, it's called manas. It's real simple. It's just simple perception, the arrangement or coordination of the stimuli of the five senses. So the consciousness, the fifth skandha, just contains this, and employs thought patterns. So now I'm going to introduce the second, what we call nidana, which is called habitual patterns. So we have this kind of big ocean of ignorance, which we're all floating around in. And, you know, when we're not in real awareness, that's where we are. That's all there is to it. There's no ifs, ands, or buts. We are either awake or not. But awake is not like an alarm going off and, oh, you know, I'm awake. It's subtler than that. It's just being present. It's fundamental presence. It's always there. We just don't see it. But these sankskaras, they're called, are basically these patterns that we have. And that's connected with the alaya, the eighth consciousness. Is this making sense at all? In other words, that has to come from somewhere. Why is it that these patterns have to sort of be inherent somewhere? They have to be stored somewhere so that they can end up showing up and manifesting as they do.
And the samskaras are the fourth.
They are all in the fourth skanda.
The fourth skanda.
Because that described, I wasn't here for that evening, but that was the when you're talking about all these different factors of what we traditionally call mind. Positive, negative, and neutral. They aren't only bad things, they also consist of good things, what we would call virtuous aspects, in addition to being problematic aspects. They're all of it. So the patterns themselves are fundamentally these kind of repetitive, iterative, you know, the word iteration, the thing that continues to try to repeat itself and follow some kind of a predictable line. That's a pattern. And these patterns, as we say, are problematic in that they are hijacked by this notion of me and turned into something which is trying to be solid, consistent, and, you know, always holding up and basically making it work somehow.
So the fifth skanda is the fruition of a delusive instant, right?
Yes. It's all okay. Coming to a head, as it were.
An instant of, the fruition of an instant of delusion.
That's what we could say, because what we've been studying is how are things deluded? You know, when we talk about fundamentally being confused or bewildered, which we started out from the very first skanda, the bewilderment is this kind of like just feeling not at ease and fundamentally being thrown off and completely unable to cope with discontinuity. Okay? Discontinuity is, you know, even though it sounds like an unusual term, it's the most frequent thing that's happening. From the point of view of just everything beginning and ending on the spot, all the time, just continuously. Universes, sitting here at this room at this table, universes are being created and destroyed in an instant. And you know, all of this is happening, and there is this thing in ourselves which wants there to be a thread, which is, well, you know, it's not here anymore. How do I organize?
Which is the movie, the image we mentioned before of old days when there was film, each block of the film is distinct. That's how Disney made cartoons. But then when you run it through the machine, it there's movement and it looks like there's, you know, something happening.
Instead of all individuals, they're just stills, but they're running up through the projector.
So that's a really good example because we can all understand that example. And when you run it through the machine, it's a movie. So we're creating our movie that way, minute by minute by minute. We're adding it all up, and we think it's something.
And so that running through the projector, that kind of running, that seamless kind of connectivity, that's the consciousness.
Okay, that's great.
And so basically what it's as Trungpa Rinpoche says, it's catching the chips of ignorance, the undergrowth of thoughts, unconscious thoughts, the padding, it supplies the context, the thread or the sequence. So the flow of unconscious, the flow of the unconscious. I mean, it's easier to understand this in dreams. If we have any kind of recollection of dreams, we know how they can switch, but during the time that it's happening, it's just you're there, it's happening, it's just this flow, right? It may switch instantly, but fundamentally altogether, it turns into this thing called my take.
And that's where dreams, like if you start looking at your dreams, you may just get a flicker of something, and then later you realize, oh, I just had that little piece of thought during the day, and I pulled it out, and it appeared in my dreams. And so that's another example of how we're creating our reality.
And then, of course, pulling it out is like you're pulling it out of the aliyah, because that's the storehouse. The storehouse isn't only long-term. It's also very short-term, whatever might happen to you an hour ago or something. It's all going into this big stream of unconscious stuff. So that, now meditate. So basically this flow is the seamless stitching and the ground for the skandhas, all the skandhas to feed on. Meditation breaks this momentum, as I was mentioning. It reveals what's underneath. We actually can see what's there. Did anybody bring a book tonight?
I have a book.
Okay. There's page bottom of page 74.
Which version? Edition.
This is
which different. That's the newer.
Sorry. That's. I'll just read it then. Consciousness constitutes the immediately available source of occupation for the momentum of the skandhas to feed on. And as we discussed before, meditation provides almost the only occasion for this momentum to stop. The other times it can stop is, you'll notice, if somebody dies that you're close to, you'll notice how people suddenly, they get very soft and they get very open. They are actually really curious and they're really kind of present. You know, you go to a funeral, visit your relatives, suddenly these relatives are very different from their normal selves. And, you know, everybody's really there. And they may be grieving, but I mean, fundamentally there's also something else going on. There's an issue, a suspension of the normal way of interacting. Now, 2 weeks later, it's all over. They're back to their stuff. But I mean, you know, if you've been around dead people enough, you know, this is how it works. You know, I mean,
or even dying people.
Yeah, dying people. I mean, but you see how it works.
Right.
And but it's also for weddings, right? I mean, anything that has
it can. There are different. But generally, that's been for me the most consistent. Weddings very different, depending on what you're ingesting at the wedding and
I mean, could be. It could be like things that just like
if you're actually witnessing the presence of a baby coming out of the womb, that will stop your mind. We are talking about what stops the mind.
Yes.
And so when you meditate, we are engendering a very gentle and simple way, direct way to stop the mind without making a big deal about it. I think I know dancers have talked about how when they and I studied with this guy who is famous for stopping the mind. I mean, not him directly, but his students, Gurdjieff, who basically was a dance instructor, and he would have people doing these different dances and suddenly say, stop. And everybody just, wherever they are, whatever position they're, just hold the position and stop. And hold that for maybe 2 minutes, which is very difficult in some cases.
Yeah.
But the idea is that everything stops. And so, you know, at that point, there's this moment, right, of openness. So that's how these patterns get broken. So meditation, this is how it plays its very important role. It provides some gap in the movement of the sankhara-type thoughts and even in the fabric of consciousness-type thoughts, a gap which contains no kindling twigs, a gap that that creates a sort of chaos in the psychological process, chaos in the mechanism of building up karmic situations. That chaos helps to see what is underneath all these thought patterns, both of the explicit and subconscious types. It begins to reveal what's underneath. So that's why Trungpa Rinpoche had one of his aphorisms was, chaos should be regarded as extremely good news.
So what he means by chaos, I guess, is that you're not organizing.
That it's a breakdown of our karmic patterns that momentarily fall apart. And, you know, if we're really there and we can train ourselves, we don't have to simply pick the pieces back up and start the whole thing over again. It can pop it.
good.
And so, of course, now we know, frankly, and from experience, old patterns die hard. Mm-hmm. They're not going to get resolved in a 10-minute moment of insight, mm-hmm. but they're going to get very weakened.
Right.
And so when that happens, the practice just to continue, that's why daily practice is so important.
It's some of us are practicing, we're practicing to be awake when we're on the cushion. So that's if you think of it as practice, it's actually you have these, you're actually pinning yourself to this spot so that you can actually watch what's happening and practice seeing, dropping the pattern.
Like a fire drill.
It makes me think of riding a bike, and I think it was Elisa's husband who said this, that he was just riding along and he went, I guess he was going through the woods or something, and a stick mm-hmm. got caught in the wheel, and there was an instant stop mm-hmm. and threw him right off the front of the bike,
mm-hmm.
and I think of that in terms of the wheel and samsara mm-hmm. and this whole patterning. It's like something that just interrupts it, mm-hmm. and our, as Erica said, the meditation itself is an interruption in this cycle of thought, build it all up.
So as we do this, as we see these breaks, as we see things pop momentarily, we actually can start to see, this is where the prajna, which is the vipassana side of our meditation, comes in helpfully. This is where this comes to work, is we can actually start to see this baggage. We can actually see these patterns. We can be able to see, oh, here this comes again. You can almost anticipate what the next thing will be. And in that process, we actually see how that film, the film that lakes in together the chaotic jumble of our neurotic thoughts, to all appear as what we call the norm or status quo, believing this is reality. I mean, in all, right now, listening to the political situation in this world and wondering where these people come from, you begin to see how they never, ever could ever stop because they'd have to stop opening their mouths and saying these crazy things they do. I mean, you know, I admit, I can only say this because we're living in a liberal bastion and nobody will get up and walk out in a huff because there are people who feel very offended when these kind of things are brought up. But basically, we're talking about just ending the storylines. And, you know, reading Pema Chodron has been very helpful, obviously. She's very good at articulating what that's about.
If you go back to prajna, you said, is the perception of the narrative?
It's seen. It's
prajna
just
is,
actually.
Is inside of, in part of vipassana. So you.
Yeah, vipassana is going to basically what gives birth to the prajna.
Okay.
The prajna is basically discrimination. It's called, if you could look it up, P R A G N A. I'm sorry, P R A J N A.
Insight.
Insight, right. Discriminative awareness. It is a faculty we have intrinsically. In our mind, and it's direct insight. It's not based on deduction, use of logic, or any of that, although it could use logic to articulate. But the factor is the direct insight is itself. It's just direct. It's not
that's what we were talking about.
Yep,
got it.
Yeah.
Okay.
There's a quote, I can't quite find the quote now that I want it, but in here there's a quote that Rinpoche just put it as simply as possible. Meditation does not partake of the skanda process.
Mm-hmm. That's in a question and answer.
He says it.
Yeah.
As simply as that.
Yeah,
it
we're
does
jumping.
Not partake of it.
So we're jumping out. And in fact, here's another way to understand this. Suzuki Roshi was a great Zen master who, you know, was in San Francisco. He was one of the people who Trungpa Rinpoche viewed as a spiritual, very close to him, one of the deepest and most profound person he'd met when he came to the West. And Suzuki Roshi said, when we meditate, we are Buddha. When we meditate, it is simple as that. Just relax. That is the Buddha mind. The meditation practice itself is Buddha mind. It doesn't matter what comes up. It doesn't matter how you feel. It doesn't matter whether you feel great about it or wonder even why you're there watching all this crap flow all around and, you know, splotsam and jetsam. It's okay. This is the Buddha mind right now. And so it that could be very encouraging for us mm-hmm. to understand that when we are meditating, we are Buddha.
That's very profound.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not to be just glossed over. I mean, that really has a profound sense of confidence that you're actually doing it. You're not just pretending mm-hmm. to do it when you're on the cushion. No matter how crummy you think your meditation is, or what a lousy meditator you think you're actually, you are doing it. You're not waiting for another being, better being of me, you to do it.
I thought we had said that most of the time we're not meditating, we're just pretending to meditate. Also, is another way of looking at
That's
it.
Fine. That's not a problem.
But that is meditation. When you're sitting there and going, I am, you're making that effort.
And if you only have a gap every
right.
It doesn't matter.
20 minutes.
Yeah. Doesn't
that
matter.
That moment, you're Buddha.
And it
no,
seems
the whole
like
time
a,
you're Buddha.
Like
you
a
are.
Really colossal.
The whole time. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I was just going to, so the stuff that comes up, basically that's okay. That's not the Buddha.
It's not rejected. That nothing yeah. is rejected. Nothing of your experience is not
unacceptable.
Is not acceptable or isn't good enough. None of it. It's actually what makes your wisdom. It creates that the possibility for prajna, for the gap to occur.
We need, frankly, our neurotic crap, our little crappy, shitty mind. We need that to wake up.
Yeah. Right.
I mean, no one has ever been able to say you don't need to go through this process because nobody's able to do it. You need this is the raw material we're working with. And so we're talking about this as a dynamic process. It's not just like, oh God, meditation.
Okay, so does that mean the whole, all right, so then the stuff is, it's emerging out of the consciousnesses, coming into the some degree of awareness, right? The flotsam and jetsam during meditation, and the idea, a key part of what we're doing is actually accepting it. That's the...
We're actually not accepting or rejecting, but we are open to allowing, we're letting everything arise.
Right.
That needs that is arising. It's arising by itself. It's not like we're saying I'm pushing this button because I want to see this storyline or this mm-hmm. particular subject or topic. It's all just emerging. And so as we just relax with that and we actually welcome it
mm-hmm.
because this is the process of awakening. So this is a key. Now this is actually very, you could say, kind of like more advanced. Because it's really talking specifically about how the prajna works. Right now, the prajna is only going to be actualized when it actually can encounter this fundamental stuff. Now, I'm not saying it's all stupid any more than it's all great. You might have days where all you do is experience glorious and wonderful arisings. It happens, you know.
there's a path-like aspect to of this, because as we relax and accept more of our mind, the more unacceptable what has been processed as unacceptable and shameful has an opportunity to arise. So we're going deeper as we allow ourselves to experience more.
Mm-hmm.
So mm-hmm. it'll change over time. We're actually moving along a path mm-hmm. of having more and more of who we are being arising, so that there is nothing hidden.
Right. So
then everything is visible.
If you're looking outward, so if you're going to externalize it, we look like we're looking at this most of the time, and the more, it seems to me, right, I guess my experience is that the more I sit, the more I feel like I get a more panoramic view of all the stuff.
Yeah, mm-hmm. like mm-hmm. you begin to realize how much stuff is going on underneath the
right.
surface. And so the reason why I mentioned this, not going into the accepting and rejecting, because it's precisely the non-evaluation
mm-hmm.
that ceases thinking. This is what we're talking about. We're actually reaching a point where we can actually somehow go beyond only experiencing thinking. And we begin to open up to a greater sense of vastness.
It just happens.
This is,
I mean, you're not creating.
No, you're not. It's a non-evaluation. But the fact we're not getting in there and evaluating, we're not putting it, we're not codifying it, we're not doing any kind of typology or analysis. We are not doing analysis. We are basically allowing things to simply arise and fall of themselves. but being absolutely present to do that. And so in that sense, even though we are relaxed because it's essential, we're also really there. We're not like going into a snooze, you know. I mean, we're actually on some level really present. It's a very important distinction to
but
make.
But it is experiential in what we're doing here. We're analyzing. We're trying to analyze what sticks us in our head, but yet we're trying to get in our hearts. So,
in the course of this talk, or in the course of meditation?
In the course of having intellectual discussion to try to lead us into our hearts.
Yeah.
We're structuring this so that we can get this. So I think that's where sometimes it can get confusing, because we're having a conversation and we're trying to understand this in numbers and sounds and stuff like that. But the basic gist is, until we relax and let go, we're not going anywhere. It's all going to stay in our heads, and we can read lists and we can read books, but we've got to get in here.
But remember, here is kind of unknown territory.
Yes.
You know, we carry a lot of assumptions about what this is.
Yes.
And
it is experiential.
For many people, it's just an emotional center. You know, it's where all their deeper or feeling centers come from.
Right.
But when we talk about mind in Buddhism, people generally talk about here as being the nature. This is where mind is. This is where the
heart
is.
Can I read something a little bit from the meditation chapter? And he's talking about meditation practice specifically. He says, first of all, he says, it takes place on a personal level. It involves an intimate relationship with ourselves. Great intimacy is involved. It has nothing to do with achieving perfection or achieving some absolute state of the other. It's purely getting into what we are, really examining our individual, actual psychological processes without being ashamed of it. Unless we're able to make friends with ourselves, that means with all the shit as well as all the glory that we are, there's no hope at all. If we abandon ourselves as hopeless, as villains, then there's no stepping stone. If we take that attitude, then we must constantly be looking, for something much better than ourselves. And that attempt to outrace ourselves on the spot can continue perpetually on and on and on. And in fact, that's just what we do. So I'll just read two more sentences. So meditation is coming into contact with the actual situation of ourselves, the raw and rugged, painful, irritating, disgusting things going on within our state of being. That even if our state of being is disgusting, we should look into it. It is beautiful to see it.
Mm-hmm.
It is very beautiful to discover that such things exist in the natural situation. It's very beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not just talking about like, oh, it's okay that I, I like to kill my husband, whatever. No, I don't. It's beautiful. It's not just that it's like, I want to put that one away and I'll get to the really good stuff. That is the good stuff. That's not rejecting.
Yeah.
Right. So to go,
wait.
Maybe there's something
real quick. I had a situation with an employee come up where I was delivered bad news, and I found that before I was going into the meeting with the person, that I was getting angry at the news and the person. And then I stopped for just a moment when I realized what I was doing is I was creating an other. I was projecting my feelings onto this other person. And the first thing I thought was, okay, in meditation, I try to soften. And that's the only word I could come up with. Soften and open to bring the situation, recognize that there's not this separation. Mm-hmm. Let go of that separation. Because I was afraid, I was angry, and my anger was pushing and creating this object and pushing away this person so that I could distance myself and protect myself. And so when I just kind of let go and softened into that moment, the anger and the fear just dissolved, and I had a really good meeting with this person because I was able to really listen to what was happening, and what I had projected onto them was completely false.
Mm-hmm.
It was wildly false. So it kind of seems like that insight moment where I realized what my habit was doing.
Mm-hmm.
My habit was creating this distance to protect my ego, protect myself, and by letting go of that, it softened into that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So what we've been talking about the skandhas, and what he's saying here is when the thoughts dissolve through the non-evaluation, through the non-categorization, through simply being present and resting in the simple awareness of what is being seen, there are the skandhas stop. All of them stop. It brings an end to this whole process.
Isn't that amazing?
So everything we've been talking about suddenly collapses altogether. We don't have to worry about this big edifice anymore. Just nobody's there. And actually, that's pretty good when we actually experience nobody's there. It's actually a huge relief. Nobody protect, nobody to worry about, tomorrow, yesterday, stuff about who I think I'm supposed to be and why I'm not, and all the great things I should be doing and don't do, and endlessly, all the petty and big issues we carry around, it just all stops, and we're really, really here. This is the point. This is really the point. We want to be here. We really want to be simply where we are. There is nowhere else to be.
Well, what springs to mind is what you ended with last week, Michael. And you talked about, you quoted Tsongkhapa Trungpa in another place, and I'm not going to get this exact, but that the energy of the skandhas is basic goodness. So the heaping up is the problem, right? So we create ourselves. But what's underneath there, when we're not there, what's there is being awake, is Buddha nature.
So he says that later on in the chapter. He talks about however, when this happens, when the skandhas are actually completely liberated, and they are actually Buddha energies, we have these five Buddha energies, they are not operating with a big synchronization. They are actually simply operating independently. So this gets a little more, he didn't go into details about how that works, but basically what it means is that, as Michael was bringing up earlier, that everything that is occurring, all these, and all of us have been talking about, even our screwed up thoughts contain fundamental enlightened nature. And I mean, this is a difficult one to digest because we're so used to trying to reject what we don't like and think doesn't work, and trying to like view towards, if some of us are leaning towards virtue, we want to be able to do that, or we want to turn it into something creative or interesting instead of all this dreck, but actually this is it. This is actually the same material, and without our attention, and our attention is really important, without our conscious attention in the direct insight, we will never be able to understand how this can immediately transform. And so we are talking about something that has nothing to do with, anybody pushing a button or calling in a specialist or something. Mm-hmm. It's just spontaneously going to happen. And so that's, I think, what we're talking about. That's why the daily practice is so critical, to ensure that there's something. We begin to replace our flow of ego with a sense of flow of awareness.
Can I read this section?
Yes, you raised your hand first.
Oh, go ahead.
Go ahead.
Some of it doesn't seem at all like there's a flow of awareness, and it's because I don't meditate enough, but I find myself still looking around the room trying to match the shoes to the feet and wondering which shoes to do, the long black shoes. Whose narrow feet would those go on to?
So then look at that. Look at what's going on. Just look at your mind thinking. It's okay. Anything. It's everything. Everything is fine.
Yeah, that's really hard to accept, because I brought this up before, and I said, yeah, everything's like hunky-dory fine. And people said, no, we're not teaching that. But when you say everything's fine, that sounds like, you know, everything's fine.
But you're not indulging. It's different. You are not indulging. You're not simply, because what you're talking about is not simply coasting off into a discursive thought.
Sometimes I am, yeah.
I know you are.
I'm doing it all the time.
Of course.
To the shoes.
We are. We're all doing it. This is what we do.
I started arguing when I was...
We do it. And so we just basically, the point is just to notice paying attention. And if you're really willing to give yourself to paying attention, and much more, and you begin to realize, you start to switch your allegiance to this kind of writing the thought and just being the thought and just like going on back to thought, you know, as opposed to actually simply being there and paying attention.
Just
when
the thought
starts to dissipate and starts to break or pop, we you know, then we have some kind of openness. It could be just like, you know, tiny.
One cannot meditate without consciousness. At the beginning, one has to practice meditation purely on a thought level, a daydream level. It is only a pretense of meditation. One is pretending to meditate, but consciousness is being transformed by this pretense, by the suggestion that you are practicing meditation. In this way, the subconscious network, as well as the consciousness itself, is gradually broken through. The speed of the consciousness itself is slowed down, and then one gets through to underneath.
It's just really hard to accept that it's not all a big joke, the way I'm doing it. So, you know.
But you're not different from anybody else, so you need to know that. Everybody's experiencing confusion when they meditate. They're experiencing thoughts. The point is, if we don't meditate at all, we'll never get anywhere. We won't see it. But if you're willing to meditate and you show up and practice whatever it is every day, 10 or 15 minutes or whatever your daily practice is, the transformation happens to you. And whether you think it's happening or not, whatever is going to go on, just notice it. And that's the process. So you can stay in that view, and eventually it'll crumble, because you'll see that it's transformed. It will transform in some way.
Waiting for the crumbling, I guess.
It's happening.
We're all in the bottom of the barrel. Like, this is, you know, and so don't worry. It's not like we're all, and from that point of view, we're fundamentally in the same boat. The boat is, you know, our confusion, but it's also the liberation is right there in the same pot. So it's 9:00, and I have to stop. But I would like to, you to really consider rereading this chapter, or if you haven't read it, read it at least once, and maybe just check off with a pencil if something popped out to you as being significant that you might want to contemplate and think about later, because this is one of the most profound texts that exist in the English language in terms of our working with meditation and how we can actually learn to understand what is going on. And so I highly recommend it. I mean, I've been teaching out of this book for the last, 15 years or something, And I found it tremendously personally rewarding, continuously revealing new aspects and insights that, you know, I could not grasp, you know, when I began reading. And I must have taught this class 4 or 5 times so far, you know, where I had a group of people and we just worked on this together, and it was an absolutely wonderful experience. So I highly recommend working with it and rereading. I think this consciousness chapter is kind of like a tipping point, as it were, because if you really can get at what he's saying here, then the rest of the whole thing starts to make much more sense. It's like, well, I didn't get that when I was just, you know, thrashing through that first skanda, but now, you know, you sort of go, oh, well, this is why. This is all this kind of chatter and racket that's going on, and, you know, somehow I can work with this. This is actually within our capacity to actually directly encounter the things that emerge in our experience.
So for next week, then you can finish the book. The last 2 chapters are Auspicious Coincidence and Practice and Intellect. And that will be the last class in this module, Module 10. And then we have 2 holiday days, so we won't be here. And we'll be reconvening in January with a new module, which you'll find out about later.
When will we find out?
And if you want to continue asking questions on the Gmail group,
yeah, keep going.
Perfect
with
format for bringing up questions. Well, this is a perfect opportunity to share these kind of questions with each other, because what happens is we're, you know, it doesn't only have to, it could be private communications if you want to do that. But at the same time, we're all enriched by everybody's questions.
Mm-hmm.
And there is no one who is not a major contributor and actually a teacher in this process. That's the important thing. And so trust yourselves about this. You know, trust yourselves and have confidence. This is really well worthwhile participating in.
Can I just toss in that on this last topic, the Andrew Holochek section on frustration was really helpful. And mm-hmm. seems to remain to what we're talking about tonight.
Yeah, maybe you could just post a little thing about that.
That
would be nice to share. Yeah. That would be great. For
is that part of what I put on the website?
Yes.
It is, yes. So it's on the website.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
we'll
be there.
Right. Yeah, we read it a while ago, right?
Read it again.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
Frustration by design.
There you go.
All right. So...